Welcome back to the Outdoor Adventures Podcast. Today in the studio, I have Dylan Williams, John Gaderos, and special guest, Kevin Mansky. Hey, Kevin.
How you doing, Sam?
I'm good. And we've been trying to get you on here for a while. You're a busy guy. Thought it'd be cool to just chat with you about some of your experiences in the outdoors. But before we jump into that, I'm going to share a story that I posted on the Facebook site for the podcast. Timothy Carpenter, on September 21st, 2023, in Humboldt County, California, shot a Roosevelt elk preliminary score of 439 and 7/8 points, which would smash the current record of 419 and 6/8. So Dylan and I did some measuring of animals, what was it, last weekend?
Yeah, I think so, last weekend.
In the trophy room, and it's not as easy as I thought it was going to be.
No.
And I realized that my brother's mule deer is giant, and I'm kind of jealous about it.
Well, I did notice, too, because I looked into scoring a little bit after you were gone. There's different ways to do it.
So you think maybe we didn't do it right? Or you think we
did? I don't know. I just seen people like that inside spread measure from different points than what we were doing. So I don't know.
We might have cheated a little bit. I feel like we were conservative in some ways, but I don't know. Because we were kind of taking the smallest spot on the inside spread. But that... My brother's buck is 160 to 170 inches, somewhere in there. I'm confident in that, yeah. And that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's still crazy. That's
but big. Still, the reason I like to bring up these stories is we all think the big ones are all gone, and obviously people are still getting big ones. I talked about that Minnesota elk that was like the third largest in the world a while back that was found frozen in the snow.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool to know that there's some big ones out there still.
I think he should have had a score, though.
Yeah, it would have been more accurate, yeah, for sure.
Done it way better.
And so Kevin, I've known Kevin for a lot of years. He used to own a gun shop here in town called CNS Firearms, and I bought a gun from you. I don't know. I was going to bring that receipt in today to see how much you overcharged me.
I would have signed it for you. You could frame it if you wanted to.
Yeah, I got to put it on the wall.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah. I once bought a gun from Kevin.
Get you a glossy photo up there. Yeah, it'd be great.
So and you could sign it, maybe.
I could, yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about how you became a gun shop owner. I mean, you were in law enforcement. Did you just always kind of like guns or...
Well, it started out, my grandpa was a gunsmith, so I grew up in the whole, you know, gun world. I was shooting since I could hold a gun. One of the funniest stories was when my grandpa was in a wheelchair, he had cancer, and they burned his spinal cord during treatment. So he went from a bodybuilder chiropractor to a wheelchair, so he started refinishing gun stocks and guns and stuff like that. So we're in the, he was teaching me to shoot when I was like 5 or 6, and we're in the garage in my grandparents' house, and they had just put in a brand new garage door. And grandpa was using the backstop or the door as a backstop. And grandma comes home and there's like 200 BB pellets coming through the brand new door. And oh, she was pissed at him. But anyway, from then on out, I was hooked. So when I was a police officer, I was a firearms instructor there. And thought when I retired, I either want to start a brew pub or a sporting goods store. And I got the opportunity to start CNS Firearms, and then that morphed into CNS Training. And we had the whole thing. We had laser shot simulators in there. So that's kind of how it happened.
I never did the laser shot, but you were like shooting zombies and stuff, right?
It was more like fats. In policing, back in the day, now it's all... virtual reality stuff. But they started out, it was like a laser, like Duck Hunt kind of sorted, but just for policing. So you could change situations based on how you reacted or how the scenario came out. So we took that further, and they took real guns and put an air actuator in there. So we had ARs and we had like Berettas and we had Glocks. And so you could, they were real life scenarios, if you will. They weren't zombies or anything like that. And then, you could react to the different, you know, different scenarios, or we had virtual ranges too. So it'd be like going into an indoor shooting range, and you can have poppers, or you can have just silhouette targets or whatever. So it was an alternative for people trying to go out to the range. And we got a lot of parties. We got a lot of kind of one-off people because it was easy, you know.
Corporate like events game. And stuff like that.
Corporate events. We had ladies' nights. We had parties, that kind of stuff.
That's cool. I wish I would have checked that out. When you
had
it'd
been really cool.
Since you're a gun guy, like what guns are like, these are the guns I have to have in my collection. Do you have like some like calibers or models, or what's your favorite gun to shoot?
I'm kind of getting out of all the black gun craze. Cause I mean, we've all got enough black guns in an AR. Kind of looks like an AR, kind of looks like an AR. I'm getting more into, and I always have been into martial arms, you know, the entire collection from like a Krag for centerfire military, a Krag all the way up to like an M14 or SP1. That I think is really cool. The antique stuff, the old 94s, the like the 3220 lever actions and kind of some of the old cowboy stuff. I'm not really into black powder. It's just not what I'm into, but there's a whole lineage there too also. So I think the historical stuff's really cool and the one-offs, but the new stuff all kind of looks the same. And I think most of us have one or 10 Glocks and, you know, it's SIG, Glock, Beretta, they all kind of look the same.
Right. So your grandpa did refinishing and stuff like that. Did you have any guns that you remember from that time that was like your favorite that he did or one that you guys may have done together?
Yeah, he gave me a couple. I mean, like, I think every kid gets his first 10/22 when he's like 10. So I still have it. It's been, you know, redone a couple times. It's one of those old walnut, you know, actual steel receiver ones. He gave me a Colt 70 1911 that I still have. It's been refinished now because it was getting pretty nasty. He gave me a couple shotguns, but that Colt 1911 is probably the one. And then I have one from my mom's grandfather who was his father. So my great grandfather's, and it's an actual Colt 3220 six shooter.
Oh, that's cool.
And it has not been refinished or anything, and it's been in the family for 100 some years. So that's kind of cool.
That's awesome.
For me, guns you can look at and remember a person or have a memory with are so much more valuable as an individual than, you know, what the actual value of the gun is. So this gun that I was showing you guys before we got started, I got a model 94 3030 from one of my clients, and he's been a client for 20 years. This guy's 79 years old. He had a ton of 1894s, like original antique guns. He had, you know, all kinds of stuff. And he also had the complete pre-64 collection of Winchesters, you know, every caliber. And he just was a Winchester collector kind of thing. And it's like, to me, yeah, you know, whatever you pay for a gun, you part with that money at the time, maybe it feels more than it should be sometimes, but it's that memory of that person, you know, and you go, like, that'll sit in my gun safe. It'll be something that reminds me of that client, you know. And I got it from him before all the rules were the way they are now.
Yeah. You plan on using it for anything?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, open up site 3030. I think, you know, if I go on a black bear hunt in the coast or something, or, you know, any kind of short distance brushy type stuff, you know? Yeah. So
that'd be fun.
Yeah.
I've got a pink Cricket that I bought for my daughter when, you know, she was like 5, and it's still in the gun safe. It's too short, it doesn't fit in the rack, but I'll always keep it. Same thing.
Yeah, because it's a memory, and it's like Johnny's kind of a gun guy. He's probably got more guns than at least Dylan and I. I don't know about you, Kevin. You probably have a pretty good collection going. But
I got more than 2.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I have 2.
Those are all federally registered, I'm sure.
If you try the Diet Coke, it's a good year.
Yeah. You were a federal firearms dealer. So, I mean, you had all those things. Which, were those hoops pretty gnarly to stay on top of?
As long as you did it right, you're fine. Mm-hmm. We were sticklers. Pretty much everybody I hired at the gun shop was either ex-military or ex-law enforcement. Most of them understood paperwork. We had a lot of checks and balances. We had spreadsheets, and we had spreadsheets on top of spreadsheets. So whenever you get a trace from the ATF, you get 24 hours to get the information back to them, and we always had it back within hours. And we had ATF come in and you know, kind of snoop around a little bit, but we never got inspected. And when I gave all my information back to the ATF, because once you have to save every 4473, and once the business closes, you have to give it back to ATF. So I asked the agent, who we'd become friends over the years, I said, why didn't you guys ever do an audit on us or something? He said, well, because every time you did a trace, it came back right. We had people going in trying to do fake buys, and you guys always caught everybody. It was wired tight. And we had actually ATF agents coming in as customers and as regulars. So we had a pretty good reputation. So we never got audited, but it's because we did everything right.
So when they do a trace, that's just a random check that you did everything correctly? Is that what
My understanding is if you have a firearm that's involved in a crime or some kind of investigation. They take the serial number, and if it's a Smith & Wesson 686, okay, they'll run the number. They'll call Smith & Wesson. Smith & Wesson will say, okay, we sold that one to this distributor. They call the distributor. The distributor says, yeah, we sold that to CNS Firearms. And then they call me, and I tell them who we sold that gun to, and then they go and talk to the person. That's kind of how the trace works.
Mm, that's interesting.
And then the fake buys, they said you guys caught that every time. What do you mean?
Somebody trying to use a hunting license for a form of ID, or somebody checking the wrong box, or somebody trying to buy a lot of straw purchases. Mm-hmm. People try to, you know, their wife tries to buy a gun for their husband. The husband may be a felon.
Gotcha.
That kind of stuff.
Gotcha.
So they're testing you on all that stuff. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Isn't that? That's wild to think about.
When I worked at a gun store for, I think it was like 2 years, like right out of high school. And I mean, it was probably one of the best jobs I've ever had. And
you didn't actually ever get a paycheck.
No, it went straight back to them. But I was still living at home, so it was fine. I didn't have any bills or anything. But yeah, it's crazy, like the stuff that people, you know, put down on that stuff. And, you know, you don't know if it's that, you know, test or if it's just a real thing these people are trying to get them or not. But
it's amazing what people try too. Yeah. Like that people are like, you know, you got this huge questionnaire when you're going to buy a gun that you got to answer all these questions. And I'm always like, does anyone ever, you know, just say yes, 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 and expect you to hand them a gun?
Yeah.
Well, and from a business standpoint, the margin on new guns is so small anyway, it's not worth the risk. It's just not.
Yeah.
You're making maybe 10%.
Because what happens if you do it the wrong way? I mean, fines, they shut you down. Yeah, I mean, I figured, but is it, it's going to cost you a lot?
It all depends. They can fine you, they can charge you, they can shut you down, they can pull all your inventory. There's a whole bunch of stuff they can do. And it's just for that $50 that you're going to make on a new gun, it's just not worth it.
How come the markups are so small? Is it they're expecting gun retailers to make up for it on ammunition and accessories? And
that's kind of how it used to be until the internet came around. I'm not saying, you know, the internet was around when we had CNS, but the online, it was just starting to take off. And so the kind of the secret sauce, and it used to be, it's kind of like new cars. You can sell a new gun, hoping maybe get a trade-in on a used gun, or you can sell an extra magazine, or you can sell ammunition or something. And ammunition had about 3% margin to it. New guns had about 10. And then accessories were all over the place from 20 to 40, just depends. Well, when the internet came out and then all the big box stores came in, you lost all your margin. Mm. And it was tougher just to do guns.
Yeah, I used to know those guys that owned the Philomath gun shop. Mm-hmm. And he told me the only way he'd make money is he'd buy huge collections.
Yep.
So like $100,000 collections, and you know, maybe he'd buy it for 50 and then slowly sell the guns out to make his margin. But I mean, it would take That's him crazy. Forever to resell. Yeah. You know, those weapons. So
it's not a great business model. You have to really love it. And that's why we supplemented it with the training courses. Right. Mm-hmm. And we had a whole nother training side of it. So we had live fire, we had CHL, we had all kinds of stuff. And your margin is higher in training just because your overhead's lower and you're not buying the inventory. So that's kind of how we made it work.
Were you doing concealed classes too?
We're doing a lot of concealed classes. Mm-hmm. We were doing Oregon and Utah. And then we were doing live fire, handgun, shotgun, rifle, and then we kind of mixed and matched for all different levels and whatnot. So, yeah.
That's cool. You travel around Oregon for that kind of stuff, or was it just local?
We started out doing the Albany area, so we were down at ARPC quite a bit, and then we would go over to Bend over at COSA. And that worked for a while, and then it just got logistically too much because I was doing gun shows like 3 a month. Oh. And so trying to do everything was just not working. We had people over there, so we opted not to do COSA anymore. My buddies who were over there kept doing their thing there. I concentrated here, and that was actually better in the long run because I'm not going to Central Oregon. You're not trying to juggle two things.
Right.
Are you a pretty good shot, Kevin?
I can hold my own.
Yeah. So what's a tip for those of us that have had some challenges over the years as far as on a long gun? So you're shooting at a deer, whatever caliber, doesn't matter, but to get a good clean shot.
Put your don't wrap your thumb around the stock. Most people do that. Keep it, you know, on the other side. And it's the same as a pistol. You watch your breathing, watch your front sight or your crosshairs on your scope, and just smooth, steady press of the trigger and let it be a surprise and you'll do fine.
Yeah. Is that thumb Because it pulls the stock.
It'll rotate you this way if you're grappling too much.
And then are you going to pull right, typically, if you're right-handed?
Typically, you'll pull left.
Oh.
If you're wrapping it this way.
So I usually pull right. So.
Yeah, it was a hypothetical question.
I don't know who I was talking about. But I have been putting some time at the range, boys. I am, like, dialed now at 100 and 200. Like, boom, boom, boom.
Good.
Tight. So I'm feeling pretty good about it.
We could have used that this last year.
Hey, we got it done. Quit bringing it up.
2 feet left.
2 feet left. Go half a deer length left. I think I brought it up last time. Same joke.
I know. I'm sorry. It's just, it's funny.
That is. It was a fun. That was an awesome hunt. So Kevin, another reason I wanted to have you on the show, besides the fact that I like you and I like talking about guns, was you are the only person I know in this great state of Oregon that has killed a whitetail in Oregon. And I know that whitetail, you know, for a long time we couldn't hunt them. And then the population started growing in different pockets of the state. And now we can, and there's some hunts you put in for. So number one, what made you want to hunt a whitetail? And talk us through it a little bit. Because they're cool. Like the antlers are just different, and it's just not a common animal in Oregon.
The antlers are different. It's kind of a letdown because we're used to muleys or we're used to blacktail, and the whitetails are short. I mean, they're not huge. But my father-in-law has the farm that he grew up on is over at an Enterprise. So we have about 400 acres over there. And it's real sporadic right now because the herds move on. He's got mostly mule deer over there. But there's so little trees because we're in the steppe between the Lostine River and then up at the timberline. So that's a lot of it's cattle country. You can see forever out there. So we decided, we typically hunt on the west side, Cascade hunt most of the time, but we thought we kind of want to change it up a little bit. We're tired of rain. We're tired of viney maple. We're tired of sword fern. I mean, you guys know, and tired of never seeing anything until night, So we got tags out there. We went out to, like I said, it's called the Leap area. It's between Lostine and Enterprise. And we just started hunting out there. We saw a ton of mules, but mostly they were all does. And it happens to be when we saw the bucks, they're on the other side of the fence line. And again, you could see for miles. So we had one guy sitting on a point trying to kind of see where the deer were. And typically we saw one big 4-point, another whitetail, but he was just on the other side of the fence. And you can see for miles, everybody knows everybody. So we tried to get permission to go down there, and the adjacent farmer said no, because his daughter had been watching that same deer. 20 minutes later, we see a truck pull up, and then it goes down in the draw and we hear a gunshot. Well, there you go. So this one was just, I was sitting, it was an early morning hunt. My buddy was up walking around a point, and I was literally parked the truck, got out of the truck. I was having a cup of coffee, and I was looking up the fence line where I'd seen deer at that last night. We tried to push some through the canyon, and they went one way. And anyway, so I'm seeing a couple does, and they're always along the fence line up there. So I'm just kind of watching them, scoping them. Okay, that's fine. And then all of a sudden, I see this buck come up from the grass. And the grass is 3 feet tall, so it just kind of came out of nowhere. And looking up there, I'm thinking, is that a buck? I thought those were all does. I'm looking through it. Sure enough. So I put the crosshairs on him, and it was about a 360-yard shot uphill and took him out, and we got it.
So did you have like a buck tag? It didn't have to be a whitetail, or did it have to be a whitetail?
No, it was a buck tag.
Yeah. Okay, that's nice. That takes the pressure off a little bit. I mean, I think you could probably easily tell the difference between a mule deer and a whitetail in the field.
It's obvious.
Yeah.
It really is.
I just don't think I've seen very many whitetail. That one big buck, me and you and Kyler that day, I still think he could have been a whitetail, which would be odd, but it was just a giant,
The way he looked, for sure. But
just the rear end of him,
Yeah. But I feel like whitetails, would you say that that's a little body size difference compared to blacktail?
Yeah, bigger body.
Bigger body.
Smaller antlers.
Okay.
When I had him mounted, it looks like a baby, but it was about a 3-year-old buck. I mean, he wasn't small. The body was actually pretty big. It took up the entire quad to get him on the back of it to try and get him back to camp. But the actual antlers, I got a picture of them, they're not too big, which is different because a three-year-old muley would have, you know, a lot of antlers. This one's, they're different.
Well, and it's also an Oregon whitetail. I mean, those ones you see in Kansas and these places, they're eaten in cornfields, you know, and they, like we were talking earlier, the nutrients to grow those antlers. And like a lot of those places, they're putting antler max and all these different feeds out there to grow those antlers as crazy and as big as they can get them. And in Oregon, I mean, I don't know the history on whitetail, if they were kind of invasive or what the deal was, or, but I know we could never hunt them for a long time. Then all of a sudden, certain areas you can.
Well, so. And the nutrient thing, like we were talking earlier, when you're in that steppe area, it's grass on top of rocks, and it's marginal cow country at best. The ranchers still have to augment with feed and hay and everything, and nothing grows there. I mean, that's, it's just kind of the way it is. So there's not a lot of nutrients up there unless they're finding it from like a farmer's stash or something like that.
And you do a fair amount of sage rat hunting out there too, don't you?
We do. That's fun. Yeah. When the rats are out, I've done Northern California, I've done Southern Oregon, I've done East Oregon, Central Oregon, but when the rats are out, it's fun.
What do you hunt with on that?
It depends. If it's long distance, I've got a CZ and 223 with a set trigger. That's really nice. 22-250s are nice also. You get kind of more of a splatter with them, but you can't. Sometimes the recoil is so tough on a 22-250. You can't keep looking through the scope and see the carnage. You got to kind of look up. So, but if it's closer range, I've got a bunch of 22 mags. I'm kind of a 22 mag guy personally. I like 17 HMRs, but if it's really windy, sometimes it blows that bullet around a little bit. Mm-hmm. I just happen to like 22 mags.
And you guys have like a safari looking rig. I think you've shown me pictures of it where you go out there and you line up on that thing and start shooting sage rats. Yeah,
Dad's got an old Jeep Cherokee that the top's been completely cut off. So there's things just a rattle trap, but yeah, it never leaves the farm.
I mean, how many rounds are you on a sage rat day, and like how many rats you think you're taking care of?
If they're really out, if we're out there all day, you could in the thousands probably. I mean, we go through bricks of 22.
Oh, that is so much fun. Yeah, I've always wanted to go shoot sage rats. Like, that's just been my, like, I want to go so bad.
Well, there's guys that totally, they specialize on it, and that's just their thing. Yeah. And, you know, and you can really set up the right optics and the right setup to do it. And I mean, from what Kevin's shared with me is, you know, you shoot one and then all of his buddies come out to eat him. And then, you know, you're...
We used to go, Bruce Allen and I used to go down to a place in Northern California. And it was Cedarville where you had to kind of pay to play. But some of those rats were out 200 and 300 yards. And that was fun. That was a challenge.
Oh, yeah.
What's the longest shot you think you'd take on a big game animal?
Depends what kind of gun I had. I mean, if we're doing 300 Win Mag, I mean, I've shot consistently out to 500 pretty easily. And, you know, guys say they can shoot 1,000 yards. 1,000 yards is a long way.
Yeah.
It really is. I'd consistently 500 easy, I think.
Dang. Yeah.
Johnny took a couple 1,000-yard shots in the wind at the range.
Yeah. A friend of mine, I have a spot just outside of Sweet Home that we shoot at a lot. And we can get out to 1,200 yards there. And we were there, and it was a nice day. So we were like, we had some extra ammo. We're like, why not? So we set a gong up out there at 1,200 yards. And it was difficult, but we hit it a couple times. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There's a big difference. And we've got a gong out at about 1,000 yards at the ranch. I found personally, it's a big difference in shooting the 1,000-yard stable target than it is shooting something that's moving that you can barely see.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
It's a whole different. So comfortably, I'd take a 500-yard shot. I think about taking anything more than that.
Yeah. That's how I feel too.
You have a specific set of guns that you pick to take hunting?
You know, if I'm going deer hunting, I have my little Savage 308. It's a police carbine, so it's a little shorter. I got a can on that. I've got a nice Nikon scope on there. So that's what I use for 400 yards and in. It's just kind of an all-around gun. Mm-hmm. I got a Model 70 that in '06 that I use too quite a bit. 300 Win Mag's nice. I was a big kind of a Savage believer when I had the gun shop. That was kind of when Remington was going through their time. So I kind of really liked Savage. We were the Savage LA dealer for a while. So they have a good set. I mean, that's that kind of that bargain price. It's you know, quality is good, price was good. So I got a lot of Savage at the house. CZ makes a good gun too. Yeah. I mean, you know, and if it's shotgun, I guess Brettas were nice.
Have you played around with these new calibers, like the PRCs?
I have not spent a lot of time with them. We closed the shop in 2016, so I've just been playing around doing other stuff.
Yeah. focusing on other stuff in your life. You got a lot going on. You're a busy guy. Kevin's a marine guy too. So he does a little crabbing. Is it like a fishing crab combo when you're out there with your boat?
It could be. I've been crabbing for, since about 2000, give or take. So if I like to go crabbing personally better than fishing, I'm kind of impatient. So if you're crabbing, you're doing something. If you're fishing, you're sitting there and hoping something bites. And then if something bites, you land it, you're great. It's a great day. The other day I was out fishing with my buddy Damon Struble. I think you know Damon. And I boated 2 Chinooks in the first half an hour, and then we sat there for 6 hours waiting for everybody else to go. So yeah, it's kind of like, okay, this is fun. But yeah, when I'm crabbing, it's typically we'll go out with 4 guys that run a line of 12 traps, and we'll kind of try to prospect where they are. And then once we find the crabs, we just go in and slay them.
Mm-hmm. Are you doing Yaquina Bay or Walport, or like both?
Kind of a mix. I've done Yaquina a lot more. I know Newport better. Mm-hmm. One thing we're seeing in Yaquina is the red rocks are everywhere. There's a ton more red rocks. There's no red rocks in Alsea. Oh. Or in Walport. So, but the thing with Walport is there's only really one good place to go crabbing, and everybody's there. So there's 200 pots in one area. Where Yaquina, you can kind of jump out to the jaws, you can go up around or the other spots we have. And what we're also seeing too lately is there's now all these Facebook pages, and everybody's saying where the crabs are. Yeah. And it's kind of like, guys, if you're, if you're fishing, you know. Come on.
Yeah. I'm a believer in sharing techniques, but not locations for most things. You know, I mean, just because figure those out over time. I mean, you can follow the other boats, but the salmon fishing this year was like that. There was, and I didn't fish this year or 2023, but I heard there was just boats everywhere on the river. It was just like a, you know, especially like the Sluts River was just like a, because you had bobber guys and you had trolling guys and you had everybody in everybody's way. I guess it was pretty ugly.
We would alternate between going up the Alsea and hitting the mouth. And at the mouth, there's 30 boats out there. And they're all trying to do the same thing. And you're getting your lines tied up with each other. And then up the Alsea, it's a racetrack. Yeah, one way going up, one way coming down. And it's just this clockwork of boats all day long.
Yeah. God, that'd give me such bad anxiety.
Oh, yeah. No, well, I was talking to this guy the other day, and he had a video of this guy hitting his boat twice. Oh, and then the guy took off, and they ran him down, and they said, hey, man, you snapped our rod and hit our boat and then took off. And the guy's like, oh, sorry. Yeah,
you know? I didn't mean to.
Yeah. They did get a little bit of cash out of him, but not a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
Not enough for a rod, even.
Yeah.
Just a couple crazy chicken strips, maybe.
Well, and that is the thing. I don't know. It's funny how the Oregon outdoor stuff has shifted. You know, when the salmon fishing was bad, then everybody switched to sturgeon and everybody's sturgeon fishing. And then the Columbia was just slammed with boats. And then we fished that population down a little bit. And so then they cut back on what you could catch. And then the salmon has been good. And, you know, outdoorsmen are hungry, especially fishermen. I feel like hunting, there's enough territory for all of us to cover that there's certain areas where, oh, there's a guy on that clearing. There's a guy over there.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a battle sometimes.
But I feel like the fishing thing is tight. Crabbing's not as bad, but
crabbing's not. Well, there's a lot of crab pots out there, but the cost too. I'm hearing a lot of people kind of shy away from the outdoor sports because it's getting expensive. Yeah. You know, how much per pound is it to go kill a deer when, you know, you can go to Costco and get a hamburger for, I mean, if you figure a quad and you figure your trip and your gas and your everything that goes into that week of camping or hunting, which is mandatory if you're a guy, I get that, but it's expensive too. Mm-hmm. And that's keeping a lot of people out of it.
Well, in Kevin's normal hunting lodge experience, he's got some remote cabin that it's a bunch of ex-law enforcement guys, right? They go up there and he takes his son and he's got a bunch of buddies and they all go up there. But they have like, there's also a lake. So they have a fishing tournament. It's like a big hangout, but then they also hunt. And they don't typically kill a lot of deer, but somebody did this year.
We did last year. Mark got one. If a deer commits suicide while walking through camp, we'll probably take it. But it's more of a fishing trip. We got keys to a lake, and it's a gorgeous lake. And we have more fun fishing than we do anything else.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And I think we talk about that a lot, too. Like it costs a lot. And, like, yeah, it sucks if you don't get anything. Like, you're out that money. But then, like, also, like, I'm sure, like, the trips are, like, the memories that you make during those trips are, like, what it's really all about.
Kind of. You can't put a price on that.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, for me, I don't care how broke I am. I'm probably going to make time to go on fishing or hunting trip. Yeah.
I actually wrote this into my wedding vows that I take a week off. Usually it's the third week in October every year. And we've been doing this for like about 30 years. Same guys. And this just, you know, that time is sacred. I don't know. Half the time we don't even get a deer tag because I'll go out to the farm or something and get one. But it's just going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's making the memories.
Yeah. And that's smart of you to get it, you know, in front of witnesses like that. Yeah.
Oh, it was in front of 200 people. Yeah. I said, hey, you know, yeah, this is the deal.
Yeah.
I
left like, hey, out on mine. Yeah. Hey, just so you know, there's no getting out of this. And a lot of people heard me say it.
Yeah. We should have talked to him a few years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. She also made me write in there that I will never give directions to her with north, east, south, and west.
Have you stuck to that?
I slip up once in a while and she reminds me.
Yeah. Well, you got to keep each other accountable, you know?
You have to.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Well, what else we got to talk about, boys? We got the sportsman show
today.
We're heading to the sportsman show when you guys listen to this podcast in about a month. but we are heading there today for the next 3 days. That's going to be fun. I'm excited to see some of the other vendors and just hang out with folks and maybe pick up some more guests for the show. And it's a good event. Willamette Valley Sportsman Show. It's always, I think, the second weekend in February.
So. It's been great to see that thing grow so much. Did you guys start going to it when it was up at the church?
No, I've only gone to it since it's been at the fairgrounds.
Yeah. So when it first started, CNS was kind of one of the sponsors of it up there. And it has grown so much. It started in, you know, one part, and then it grew out into another outbuilding, and then the parking lot at the Jefferson Baptist Church. And then when Jonathan moved over to the fairgrounds, it really started gaining traction. And it's been cool to see it grow over the past 15 years or so.
Yeah. I think we're pretty spoiled for as small of a community as this is. We have a lot, like our gun shows are pretty high quality, you know, like the Lions Club puts on one, the ARPC puts on one.
It's on two.
Or they put on two a year. Spring, yeah. But fall, I'm just saying, and I think Lions is maybe two a year too. I'm not sure, but the last one was during that ice storm. So I don't think it was very well attended, but you know, in general, they're pretty solid shows, I think. You know, I always buy something that I don't need.
Yeah. So. We did more in Albany. Usually Albany is spring and fall, and the Lions show is usually January. And like I said, I would hit 3 to 4 gun shows every month, so I was on the road quite a bit. We'd always hit Portland. We go up to Puyallup up in Washington. We hit then a smaller show like a Roseburg or a Redmond show or something.
Rick Rial.
You know, I did that a couple times, and it's okay, but ARPC by far, I think we did better, and we were local guys too. But it's just a good show.
What was your top seller when you had the gun shop?
Like magazines,
magazines.
Yeah, we were a big magazine. I had racks and racks and racks of magazines. So
you'd be in trouble with that new legislation, probably.
I'm not sure where we are. I think there's a stay in it right now.
Yeah, it's held off right now. But if it actually went through and you were capped at a 10 round magazine, then.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do with that.
Yeah, good thing you don't have a gun shop anymore.
Good thing I don't have anything that has more than 10 round magazine right now.
Yeah.
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 Uh-huh.
Yeah. Who would want that?
Yeah, it's crazy.
What about gun itself? What was the number one seller?
Oh, we were a Glock dealer, so okay. I think we sold more Glocks than anything else. Hands down. We were the law enforcement dealer. And if you looked at the price, if you put like a SIG 228 or 229 or something, or even 220 up against a Glock, SIG's a great gun. I got a bunch. They're fun to shoot, but a Glock is just, it's point and shoot. It's kind of the standard, if you will. Most people can shoot them. You can adjust the trigger a little bit if you need to. You can swap a new trigger in. And the price, I mean, back then we were selling a new Glock for $499 or something. Mm-hmm. So,
oh, yeah, and they never jam. You can cover them with mud. I mean, they're made, is the rumor, you know, they're made to perform.
Never is an absolute,
yeah.
But they
rarely
jam less frequently.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the big thing we found with Glocks versus typically the semi-autos of that time came with decockers, like a Bred 92, all the SIG series for the most part, HKs. If you don't train with them, let's face it, a lot of people just don't train enough. They forget the decocker, and that's one more step to take. Well, a Glock was kind of the first, or one of the first, to come out with no decocker, striker fire, you know, same shot every single time. And then a lot of people jumped on that bandwagon. Smith came out with the M&P, and SIG had their version. Breda came out with their stuff. So Glock was kind of the pioneer, if you will. And I mean, I'm a Glock believer. I carried a Glock for years, shot thousands of rounds with Glock. But they're easy to train people on, too.
Hmm. Yeah, I just recently heard about Polymer 90. Have you guys heard of this? Mm-hmm. So it's like a website, but it got bought by somebody else. But you can buy like all the components of a gun and basically build it yourself. And because they're selling components, you don't have to worry about the registration type stuff. I don't know exactly, but somebody was telling me about it. I'm like, then it got me itching and I was going to try to build a 10 millimeter or something. But then that weekend, exploratory session ended when my wife said, you don't really need another pistol, do you? I'm like, yeah, but if I'm in bear country, if I hunt in grizzly country, I need to have something bigger than a 9 millimeter. You know,
I used to do that a lot. Like when I was working at the gun store, was with like ARs, you could get parts kits like stupid cheap. So I'd get some of those 80% lowers and then buy a parts kit and just, I was building ARs like left and right just because, I mean, it was fun for me to do it, but, and it was pretty cheap back then, where now it's,
That's a whole nother business.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you used to do that all the time, man. I'd get so annoyed calling him. What are you doing? Building another gun.
Because I need another one.
Yeah.
That's funny.
The good thing you bought that 3030, though, I'm sure.
Yeah.
She liked that one instead of building it.
Thankfully, she doesn't listen to the podcast. So there's been a couple gun purchases that she's not aware of. So
yeah.
If anyone's on here and rats me out, that wouldn't be cool.
We would all laugh.
It was a while ago. It was a long time ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sure was.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, I guess we better go set up our booth. So we got an hour to get it all set up and rocking and rolling. But Kevin, thank you for coming. We've talked about doing this with you. And I mean, you had a lot to say. We didn't give you a ton of time to say it, but you got a lot out in a short amount of time.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being here, boys.
Yeah. Thank you.